attorney-client relationship between Moss and Barnett, a professional association, or any attorney appearing on this program and any caller or listener. Please remember that we can only give general information, and every case is unique. Always check with your individual attorney for any specific legal concerns. If you are in need of specific legal advice or are looking for an attorney, please do not hesitate to give Moss and Barnett a call at 612-877-5000.
This is WCCO's Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett.
Good morning. We are back in studio after 2 weeks at the fair. Tom Schroyer is our host. Tom, great to see you.
Good morning, Steve. It is great to be back in studio here. We have a terrific program today with Shannon Bixby Pankratz and Jim Vetter from Moss and Barnett's Family Law Department. And we're going to be talking about what's happening in family law with all of the changes in the family. Should be a great program. We hope people will have a chance to call in or text in with any questions or comments they might have.
And by the way, the number is there, 651-989-9226. Toll free, 1-866-989-9226. Your calls and your texts are a big part of the program, and you can send the text 81807. That's 81807, and that is powered by Home Service Plus, an offering of CenterPoint Energy. Tom?
Thanks again, Steve, and welcome to Shannon Bixby Pankratz, her first visit to our program. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's great to have you here, along with Jim Vetter, another colleague of ours from the award-winning and very distinguished family law practice area at Moss and Barnett. Good morning, Jim.
Morning, Tom. Thank you much.
I'll share briefly again, Steve, both Jim, as I've mentioned before, and Shannon are both rising stars designated by their peers in a survey conducted by the super lawyers folks who run surveys here in the Twin Cities and throughout the United States in, of America. And so that's really quite a great honor for both of them. Jim is also a frequent lecturer on family law matters, and Shannon brings with her a tremendous background to family law. She served actually as a probation officer in Hennepin County for a number of years, as well as judicial clerk to the family law court. So great expertise, and of course, again, both attorneys spend their careers focused on family law, which, my goodness, I must say, Shannon, it seems like every week when we get the new case decisions issued by both our Minnesota Court of Appeals and occasionally even the Supreme Court, they're just chock full of family law cases.
We have a number of cases, both unpublished and published, every week.
Yes, it must be hard to keep up with.
It is hard to keep up with.
Sure, and the combinations and permutations of what constitutes a family, of course, have been changing and putting great and different pressure, creative pressure, I might add, on our judges to keep up with.
That's correct. The statute, actually, in the legislature defines family very distinctly as a relationship between a man and a woman. And we see that in recent debates that have been going on, but that extends much beyond just the relationship of a same-sex marriage that's currently under debate. There are many other non-traditional families that are developing for a number of different reasons that the courts are now seeing.
Right, and I want to make it clear at the start of the show that we're not expressing our personal opinions here about what the law ought to be or has been or whether it's right or wrong. We are just explaining, of course, the challenges under the law that the courts are wrestling with and how they're ruling on them because, of course, important legal rights and, crucially important life rights and issues are at stake. And so, Jim, it is a matter of some controversy I'm sure you have to deal with and your practice in some of these situations.
Yeah, we see it quite frequently because there are many different family law issues that come up. It's not just the traditional husband and wife issue anymore. Now you've got a lot of paternity cases where people are not married, they have a child together, or you have people who just are not getting married. They live together, they cohabitate, and just like that, they don't want to take the next step into marriage.
Shannon, what are you hearing from people in terms of why they're not taking the step of entering into traditional family relationships?
Well, one of the issues or one of the common theories is it's a marriage certificate. It's just a piece of paper. But there's a lot of legal implications to that piece of paper. A relationship between a husband and a wife carries with it a fiduciary duty to one another, and the courts really look to protect, and the legislature really looks to protect that relationship.
Yeah, you mentioned the legislature, Shannon. That's been really where the battleground, if as it were, for over the, you know, the same-sex marriage issue, and we'll have a constitutional amendment to vote on in this state in the 2012 election. But leaving that aside, it's become pretty clear that it is the legislature that defines what is a family and who has rights inside a family, in particular with regard to who has rights to visitation and obligations to support children.
Yes, the legislature sets the structure for the courts to operate under. So the legislature decides who can and cannot bring an action in court, whether it's a traditional family or not. Jim had mentioned the paternity statute, which is an area of the law, of family law, that addresses unmarried couples that have children together, and that's specifically related to rights regarding the children. There's also issues regarding child support. But there's other types of families out there. There's multi-generational families.
Can I interrupt and ask, what is a multi-generational family?
A multi-generational family is a family where there's just, it's more living in a household than just a mother, father, child relationship. You have parents for, you know, cultural reasons. Parents of mother and father live with the family. For financial reasons, a lot of people are living in multi-generational environments. They need somebody to care for their children. They need, there's only one parent there, so they need the extra additional help of an extended family member to participate in raising their kids.
I imagine that all of the new science and the tremendous accuracy now of DNA testing for paternity is also creating some waves for you folks in family law.
Yes.
Indeed. And people are coming out of the woodwork to challenge paternity after many, many years, or to establish paternity in some cases based on, again, DNA testing.
That is correct. And that's an expensive process for both the courts to undergo, at least in the local counties. Hennepin County, for instance, they do offer those services through some of the courts. However, private testing can be pretty significantly expensive to do if you're going through a private place to have that testing done. So it is a burden for the courts to have to go through paternity testing.
Jim, have you seen many such cases?
Yeah, actually, we see quite a few of those types of cases, Tom. And one of the things that you're finding more and more is that there are multiple presumptions as to who can be the father of a child.
How can that be?
I know that's interesting. Shannon and I were talking about this yesterday, and it's interesting because you could have the biological father. There's one presumption. But if a child was born during wedlock, that father is a presumed father as well, even if he's not the biological father. So you could have two competing interests, and now our court has to weigh who's actually going to be the father.
All right. So let's say that I'm in a marriage, as Shannon said, with a marriage certificate, and I have a child with my wife, or at least I think I do, and then, you know, 15 or 20 or whatever years into the marriage, for whatever reason, I decide to have DNA testing done, and it's conclusively proven that I am not the parent of the child whom I've raised as my child through all of these years. What happens?
Under the statutory framework, you are still a presumed father for that child. And in addition to that, the actual biological father would be a presumed father. So now it's up to our courts to decide who's actually going to parent this child, the biological father or the father who has served in that role for several years. And it'll come down to a best interest analysis, Tom, ultimately, as to who's going to take care of the child.
We have more on the way. A fascinating topic today. All the times they are changing, the changing definition of family and its legal implications. Jim Vetter and Shannon Bixby Pankratz in studio. Tom Schroyer is our host on the program today. It is Minnesota Law each and every Saturday at 11 a.m. on News Radio 830 WCCO.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Did you know Moss and Barnett's attorneys help to found and remain active in the Minnesota Legal Advice Clinics and similar organizations, including the Fund for the Legal Aid Society?
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
This is News Radio 830 WCCO.
It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett Family Law in the spotlight today. Jim Vetter, Shannon Bixby, Pankratz in studio today. And, of course, Tom Schroyer is our host on the program. Here are the numbers if you have any questions on the topic today. 651-989-9226. Toll free, 1-866-989-9226. Text the studio as well at 81807. That's 81807. And that is powered by Home Service Plus, an offering of CenterPoint Energy. Tom?
Thanks, Steve. We're talking with Shannon Bixby Pankratz and Jim Vetter about the changes in the traditional approach to family law occasioned by different relationships that people are having, and one of those is multi-generational family formation. And there was a recent case, Shannon, that came out of our Minnesota Court of Appeals that nicely illustrates what's happening, as well as some of the limitations on what the courts can do in a situation where a grandparent really was the, as I understand it anyway, the main custodial parent, and then the biological parent, a daughter, as I recall, passed away, and then there was all kinds of issues around how that was going to work out.
That's right, Tom. There's a recent case that was just issued by the Court of Appeals that addressed a multi-generational family issue, as we're discussing. It was a situation where the mother was raising her daughter and raised her daughter also in the care of her mother. So it was mom, grandma, and daughter living in the same environment and in the same house. Unfortunately, the mother was killed by an ex-relationship, and so grandmother continued to raise the child for an additional, I believe it was about 4 months. Almost immediately after the death of the mother, the biological father, who was involved to a limited extent in a visitation schedule, came forward and said, "I want custody of my child."
And the grandmother was doing a good job and had a strong nurturing relationship going with this child, as I understand it.
Yes, had a strong relationship with the child, and the child had been raised under the care of both grandma and mom during that time. And this court process occurred over a 4-month period of time. Grandmother had originally brought what's called a third party custody proceeding to ask the court for custody of the child. There's stringent guidelines that are put in place under the statute as far as what a court can do under those circumstances. And so it ended, the end result was that the grandmother had no standing in the courts to bring a custody proceeding under those circumstances. And so the second step was looking for a visitation schedule. Under both the paternity statute for unmarried families and under the marital statute for married families, there is an allowance for a grandparent to seek visitation. Now, that visitation schedule, or the standing, only applies to a grandparent. So unfortunately, if you have other aunts and uncles that are just as close as a grandparent, they don't have any standing in the courts. They can piggyback off of the grandparent in supporting that request for a grandparent visitation schedule, but they don't have any independent standing for a visitation schedule similar to a grandparent.
So how did the court, in the case of the grandmother with the deceased biological daughter, how did the courts deal with the grandmother's request for visitation?
Well, obviously the grandparent wanted to continue a very regular schedule with her grandchild. She had grown very close and had a very intimate relationship with the granddaughter. The court agreed with that approach, and the Court of Appeals then disagreed what the district court did. And the Court of Appeals premised its decision on the natural and presumed right that parents have to parent their children. And so they have an overriding U.S. constitutional fundamental right to parent your child. And if a grandparent visitation schedule appears to look more like a parent, a non-custodial parent's visitation schedule, they'll back down from that, and it'll be a reduced schedule. So the grandmother ended up having, I believe the end result was 1 weekend a month and maybe a couple days where she could see her granddaughter for 2-3 hour period of time.
So, Jim Vetter, this was a situation where, in effect, the grandparent access or visitation statute was being used to, as it were, end around and overwhelm the parenting rights statute. And the Court of Appeals said no can do.
No can do. They said basically that your parents have a fundamental right, and that fundamental right really trumps the right of the grandparent to the extent that it interferes with the parent's right to parent. And that is such a strong interest. And I think we kind of all recognize that parents have a right to parent their kids. And grandparents have a right to be involved too. And you have to look at it on a case-by-case basis. Obviously, we're not giving all of the facts in this case here now. But ultimately, our Court of Appeals said, no, this is a parent who's got that right, and Grandma, if she has every other weekend, I'm sorry, 1 weekend a month, can have that relationship.
But Jim and Shannon, if the circumstances are where Mom and Grandma were raising this child and Dad wasn't in the picture, does the court take that into consideration? I mean, is that part of it here? I mean, ultimately, what did change for the child to go, all of a sudden, I'm with Dad and I had nothing to do with Dad before?
Steve, that is an excellent question. And the court is to always look at what's in the best interest of the child. And that situation you're describing, the court is to look at what has the relationship been. Ultimately, coming back to looking at the child, but at the same time saying, well, we can't take a child away from a parent either. You know, that parent has such a strong interest in parenting their child. I agree with you. I mean, in a lot of respects, you got to look at what's best for this kid. What does this kid need? What is this kid used to? And if you take that away, especially suddenly, that could be very damaging to a child.
But the court has the ability to take a look at that. If Dad wasn't in the picture at all, and it was Mom and Grandma, and now Mom is gone, the court could ultimately say, you know, in the best interest of the child, the only parent or parents this child really knew were Mom and Grandma.
Yeah, I mean, the courts certainly have the discretion to do that. Okay. One of the nice things, courts are given a fair amount of discretion with respect to custody and parenting issues.
All right, we're going to take a break. We have more coming up. Great topic. Once again, family law in the spotlight. Jim Vetter, Shannon Bixby, Pancratz in studio. Of course, Tom Schroyer is our host on the program. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Saturdays between 11 and noon on News Radio 830 WCCO.
From the Buick Studios, this is News Radio 830 WCCO.
Welcome back. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Tom Schroyer is our host each and every week between 11 and noon. Jim Vetter joining us in studio, and Shannon Bixby Pancratz. Once again, family law and the changing dynamics of families and how it's impacted by our laws. Tom?
Thanks, Steve. We are with Shannon Bixby Pancratz and Jim Vetter. And I might note for the audience, our listeners, that Shannon was recently married. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And that's actually a good intro to where we want to head now with the program, which is to talk about the importance or the distinction that the law makes for couples who are married lawfully and those who choose to live together without getting married.
Yes, Tom. There's many circumstances that we run into in our practice where individuals are raising children together and they come to us for some of the custody and parenting time issues related to their kids. But the dynamic really regarding the relationship is they've really lived together cohabitating as if they were man and wife without the marriage certificate for many years. In those circumstances, our statutes and our laws regarding the paternity statute really only relate to the kids. So they're left with this whole mess of other property issues.
Sure. What happens, for example, when they've been living together for many years, intending to get married perhaps? Maybe they've enjoyed an affluent lifestyle. Have you run into situations like that?
We run into those situations all the time. I can think of one situation where we had a professional athlete. We had a professional athlete's significant other come to us for assistance. They had four children together, lived together for many years, lived in a multi-million dollar home. They had many nice luxury items, vehicles, property, those types of things. They furnished their house. Their kids lived a very affluent lifestyle, attending the best of schools, etc. And she came to us asking, they were separating, and asking, what's in it for me? And really, the property is owned by him. And so because they're not married and they don't have that marriage certificate, it significantly changes the legal implications and what's available to her.
And in truth, there isn't much that is available unless it's jointly titled or they have a cohabitation agreement.
That's correct. The presumption under Minnesota law with respect to a marriage is that all property, both assets and liabilities, are presumed to be marital unless there's an area under the law to exclude it. There is no such statute with respect to non-married spouses. So whoever the property, we often tell family or married couples that it doesn't really matter when you're going through a divorce how the property is titled. However, it significantly matters if there has been no marriage. So if the house is owned by father gets the house. If the furniture, if it can be shown that the furniture is purchased by him and he wants it, it's his. Spousal maintenance is another issue. That affluent lifestyle may continue for both parties beyond marriage. But if there's no marriage, there's no entitlement without some other type of cohabitation agreement.
But after a certain period of time, if people are living together and having children and owning property together, in the eyes of the state or the eyes of the court, if you will, aren't they really married anyway? I mean, people have heard the term in television and movies about common law marriage. That doesn't apply?
No common law marriage in Minnesota, Steve. Now, it's interesting because we do have a putative spouse statute, but there you have to have a good faith belief that you're married. And if that's the case, you know, and really you probably almost have to go through a ceremony of some sort and really believe that you're married. And, you know, I typically, if that's the situation, we'll look at income tax returns. How have you filed your income tax returns? Did you file them married or did you file them singly? You know, if you can show that there's a good faith belief and you've cohabitated, then you can have what's kind of like a common law marriage. But absent that, you can have what's called a cohabitation agreement. If two people choose to live together out of wedlock, have a family, for lack of a better term, they can say, look, we will agree to all of these terms on how property will be divided. You can agree to support, maintenance, so that once one individual isn't losing out. Shannon and I were talking yesterday about the scenario where you have this couple, they don't get married, they've got kids together, one individual stays home to take care of the kids, the other one pursues their career. Suddenly, 10, 12 years down the road, the person with the career says, I don't like this situation anymore. And they say, look, I'm going to go my own way. If you don't have a cohabitation agreement, our law effectively says you get to take out what you put in. So, for instance, if you paid the mortgage payments and you can show that and you can prove it, then you can get out your share of the equity out of the house. But so oftentimes in that situation, one spouse has probably built up a healthy retirement account, healthy investment accounts, healthy bank accounts. None of that will be divided. Now, is that fair? Well, I don't know. Our statute seems to indicate that it's not, so that's what the law is.
Well, a lot of interesting challenges. What happens, of course, in that situation to the children is they still get the child support.
The statute under both the paternity statute and the marriage dissolution statute protects child support issues. However, regarding parenting, it's distinctly different under both statutes. There's a presumption if you're a husband and a wife that you jointly raise these children together. However, the paternity statute is much different. There is a presumption under the statute that the mother has sole physical and legal custody of the children unless and until a court decides otherwise or the parties agree to something otherwise.
Very interesting material and much more to cover, Steve, after our break.
All right, Tom Schroyer is our host, Jim Vetter, and Shannon Bixby Pankratz in the studio. Family law in the spotlight today and the changing dynamics in families here in 2011. It is 11:41 here at News Radio 830 WCCO.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Did you know Moss and Barnett attorney Clifford A. Taney Jr. went on to fame while serving during World War II as general counsel to the super-secret nuclear development program of the U.S. Army, known as the Manhattan Project?
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
News Radio 830 WCCO.
It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Family Law in the spotlight today. Tom Schroyer is our host. Jim Vetter is here. Shannon Bigsby Pankratz in studio as well. Tom?
Shannon Bigsby Pankratz, we want to go back to a topic we were on just a moment ago before the break, and that is, you know, what happens when a couple is cohabitating? They may even have children. They've done it for many years. They don't have a cohabitation agreement. And then the party with the assets dies. What happens then to the property?
You know, that's a really interesting question, Tom. In the absence of a cohabitation agreement, it really goes back to what's in the documents themselves. There is no marriage statute that would apply that would protect the fiduciary relationship, even though they've cohabitated for years. So it really relies on the individual documents. So, for instance, with real property, you can hold a real property interest different ways. One would be as tenants in common. One would be as joint tenants. If you're if you're married, it's called joint tenancy in unity. So it's automatically joint tenancy. And what that really refers to is if one of the spouses dies, the other one assumes the 100% interest of the real property. It similarly applies if you have a non-married couple that purchase a real property interest as joint tenancy. However, if they purchase the property in joint tenancy in common, that surviving member of the relationship would only receive a one-half interest. They would, in essence, share that property with the heirs of the other person that they own the house with. One exclusion to that is if a will is developed. So it's important that you go to your estate planners to look at the structure of the assets that you have when you're living together, and that person can have legally defined in a document where they want their personal property and other items to go in case of death.
So now, it would be really important if someone is living with another person and they're having a family to get some legal advice and get some contracts set up, wills, estate planning, even more so perhaps than if they were actually married.
Absolutely. And the same applies to, you know, retirement assets, life insurance assets. Those are really contractual agreements. So you can define who your beneficiary is, whether it's a spouse or not. You can define who that person is. And then one issue in particular that's very different between married couples and unmarried people living together is your availability towards Social Security benefits. There's certain protections under the Social Security benefits that allow a spouse survivorship benefits. Those don't apply if you're just living with another person and there's no marriage.
So lots of care and caution. And Jim, I wanted to return with you briefly here. We have a couple of minutes before the break to talk about, you know, what happens in this situation to the children when they've been living in affluent lifestyle, as we've been talking about, with their father and father and the mother are cohabitating. What happens to them? Do they get to continue that lifestyle, or how does the child support system work there?
Well, it's a good question, Tom, and the answer really is it depends. Now, our child support statute sets up a child support maximum cap that you can get in a particular situation. The court can deviate upwards from that, but they're really going to look at the particular facts of that situation. And the case that always comes to mind for me is people in our audience probably remember the Hall & Oates band. You know, they were in the mid-80s. Silent Eyes are watching you. Steve, I don't know if you could sing a tune here for us or not.
Yeah, I won't go there.
But anyway, John Hall got a gal pregnant up in Duluth. And at the time, he was netting $1 million a month. but he'd never lived with this woman. He really didn't want a parental relationship with the child. And our court said, well, you get the maximum child support, which was at the time, I think, somewhere between $1,500, $1,700 a month. So the child was getting a fair amount of money, but certainly not living anywhere near the lifestyle that the father was living. So our courts are going to look at, you know, were these people living together? What kind of lifestyle was the child living? Was the child living an affluent lifestyle? Was it just one of the parents? But what they're not going to do is say, just by sole fact that you have a child with somebody who's a very high income earner, you don't get to increase your own support.
We have more on the way. It is Minnesota Law. Once again, family law in the spotlight today. Jim Vetter and Shannon Bixby Pankratz in studio. Tom Scheuer is our host on the program. We'll come back. We have a comment and a question from the text line. That's pretty interesting. We'll get Jim, Shannon, and Tom to address that in a moment. And we'll say goodbye and preview next week's Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett here on News Radio 830 WCCO.
From the Buick Studios in downtown Minneapolis, this is News Radio 830 WCCO.
Welcome back one more time. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. The hour's gone very quickly. Family Law in the spotlight. Jim Vetter, Shannon Bixby Pankratz in studio. Tom Scheuer is our host. Real quickly, from the text line, the text is, what about child custody if two people aren't married? What right does the father have? The father is the only one that works, has employment, bringing in money, etc. Jim, Shannon?
I think I'll answer that question, Steve. As I stated before, it's presumed if parents have never married, it's presumed under Minnesota law that the mother has sole legal and physical custody of the child or children unless and until a court decides otherwise or the parties agree to an arrangement. And so really until the father brings an action in the court, the mother has sole legal and physical custody under the statute. Now, fathers have significant rights to bring an action in the court, and depending on how the legal relationship between father and child is defined would depend on how the process of how that particular father would file an action with the court. Once an action is filed with the court, though, the same analysis is considered both with married couples and with unmarried couples, and that's a best interest factor analysis that a court has to look into. And really, Steve, there's 13 best interest factors, an additional 4 factors that are considered in joint custodial arrangements. And what's considered, just in a nutshell, is the wishes and preferences of both parents, child's preferences and their wishes, if the child is old enough, both in maturity and age, to help assist in asserting their positions. Typically, a child between 10 and 14 might start to have some influence over the court. And after age 14, as we know, teenagers walk with their feet. And so they have much more say in what happens. So it really kind of depends on the circumstances of how old this child is in determining those things. The issue with finances, the courts really try to keep that issue separate from custody.
All right, very good. Shannon Bixby Pankratz, Jim Vetter, great to meet you, Shannon. Good to see you again, Jim.
Yeah, as well, Steve.
Thank
and
you.
Tom, you'll be back next week. We have another great program lined up.
Indeed we do, with Marcia Stolt, who will be back to talk with us about more intellectual property law, this time about copyright law, which really is a tremendously interesting area of the law because it deals with so much of what we deal with in our daily life in terms of television shows, music, as well as any other way in which we express our ideas in written or graphic or performance format.
It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett.